in Glasgow, European Championships, which is in Birmingham. So two home championships, which is so exciting when you have a home crowd pushing you on that can pull out such great performances. I mean, we all saw what happened in 2012 in London, the Olympics, and how many medals we got from that. So that will be the focus for this year. And then everything is obviously in the build up to LA in a couple of years' time, but it will come by very, very quickly. It's already been nearly 2 years since Paris. So all eyes aiming to that as well.
Well, Georgia Hunter-Bell enjoying her success, rightly, a very worthy indoor 1500 metres champion. Talking to me there from Australia. Well, thank you very much for your company this afternoon. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. Roy Anika and Fee Glover are here next. They're in the studio up on Times Radio. I have to say, I don't know if you saw the image of the three women athletes as they got those golds, but it was incredible. It was an incredible moment.
It was beautiful, wasn't it? Because they are just strong and fit and fabulous.
Yes. Just and like fierce. The three of us here, in fact.
Very similar. Let's mock up that shot, Joe.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock and you're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio.
And coming up over the next 2 hours, why the son of Iran's last Shah wants Donald Trump to continue the war. We'll talk to one of his advisors. New passport rules for dual nationals have left one 16-year-old stranded in Denmark. We'll try to understand why the British government isn't helping. We're also going to hear from a mother about her battle for the truth over her daughter's fatal shooting by her father in America. As Scott Bryant's going to tell us what to watch on telly this week, and Baroness Debonair, Thangam Debonair, will talk us through the Women's Prize for Fiction, non-fiction shortlist.
But first, the news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, Roy. Good afternoon. The Health Secretary is demanding answers from an NHS trust that failed to report a suspected case of meningitis on time. Wes Streeting says East Kent hospitals took 26 hours to notify authorities when a patient was admitted a fortnight ago. But he's confident it's not hampered efforts to contain the outbreak and has praised the remarkable efforts from health staff. The Prime Minister is poised to cap political donations from Britons living abroad in a move which could cut off Reform UK's biggest donor. A report's found hostile states have stepped up their efforts to meddle in UK politics. Author Sir Philip Ryecroft has recommended a cap on donations to political parties from abroad and a pause on giving them cryptocurrency. Labour donor and green energy company founder Dale Vince has told Times Radio all party donations should be outlawed entirely.
If you look at the money that's in American politics, it's billions, it's crazy sums of money. And then you look at the toxic outcomes of that money in American politics, which ultimately produced Trump as the world's president, arguably, who's running around the globe starting wars and fires every It makes no sense to let foreign people, foreign countries, foreign companies fiddle in our politics. We allow it through media ownership, and I don't think we should do that either.
Cryptocurrency tycoon Christopher Harborne donated £9 million to Reform in December in the biggest ever donation to British politics from a living person. The oil price fell sharply and stock markets rallied following reports of a 15-point ceasefire proposal sent by President Trump to Iran. Pakistan says Iran have received the proposal. Brent crude fell 6.3% in late morning trading. That's despite an Iranian military spokesperson mocking the attempts at a ceasefire deal, insisting the US was only negotiating with itself. Hundreds of teenagers are going to take part in a trial to ban social media. Experts will look at how their family life, schoolwork and sleep is affected over 6 weeks. Science Secretary Liz Kendall told Times Radio what they're looking into.
One of which is a ban on social media for under 16s. We're also looking at overnight curfews, also breaks in scrolling with parents and children and young people to see how it goes, how people feel about it, how easy it is to implement.
Former prisons minister Crispin Blunt has avoided a jail sentence after pleading guilty to possessing cannabis and crystal meth. The ex-Conservative MP has been fined £1,200 after being caught with the substances when police searched his home in 2023. The raid followed separate allegations of rape, which were later dropped. The 65-year-old told Westminster Magistrates Court he doesn't believe possession of drugs should be a criminal offence. And former Google executive Matt Britton has been confirmed as the BBC's new Director General. The ex-president of Google's Europe, Middle East and Africa operations will replace Tim Davey, who said he was resigning in November following a storm over how Panorama edited a speech by Donald Trump. BBC chairman Samir Shah said Britton brings to the BBC deep experience of leading a high-profile and highly complex organisation through transformation. And don't forget, you can set the Times radio news briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, on the Times radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's 4 minutes past two. Welcome aboard the Wednesday Ship of News. Roy Anika and Fee Glover with you until four. We're going to start looking towards the Middle East and hear what is possibly a different perspective on the continuation of the war from a spokesperson to Reva Pahlavi, son of the ex-Shah of Iran, who wants the war to carry on, bringing this current regime to its knees in order to make it possible for a different leader to emerge. Don't worry, we've got the light-hearted story of the day for you at about 20 minutes past two. We're all very, very excited about this one. It's not funny, though, if you're Doge. And that's not Doge, it's Doge. Doge is a doggy magazine full of comic photos of dogs. It's being sued by Vogue because you would get the two muddled up, wouldn't you? Dual passports are leaving people stranded. We're going to investigate that one as well. And what does our TV critic Scott Bryan think of Channel 5's dramatisation of the fall of Hugh Edwards? We know that Hugh Edwards himself doesn't think much of it. We don't think much of you, Hugh. So we will talk about that. And we'll also talk about Mr. Nobody versus Putin, which is a fantastic documentary you can now see on Netflix. Anything else you'd like us to be talking about in our TV slot, you can be in touch with us this afternoon. After 3 o'clock, an extraordinary story from Jane Coates. You might have read her tale. Her daughter, Lucy, went to stay with her father, that's Jane Coates' ex, in Texas, and was shot dead by him. The shooting has been ruled accidental. Jane has got many thoughts about that. After 3:30, Baroness Debonair, that's Thangham Debonair, former Labour MP and now Labour peer, is our guest telling us about all of the contenders for the Women's Prize for Non-Fiction. And she is also chair of the UK Opera Association. So we had to have a little chat about Timothée Chalamet's comments that opera and ballet are just over. So all of that to look forward to between now and 4 o'clock. We do love to hear from you. So we're Jane and Fee at Times Radio if you want to send us an email, and we are 0333 003 2353 if you'd like to ping us a little WhatsApp. Most read stories so far on the Times website, please, Roya, and hello.
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 Nice to be back. Number three on the Times website today, it's Crispin Blunt pleads guilty to cannabis and crystal meth possession. The drugs were found in a raid of the 65-year-old Tory former justice minister's home back in 2023. The second most read story is Donald Trump's self-deception is what sustains him. That's a brilliant column by Danny Finkelstein. He says that from Washington to Westminster, politicians aren't just peddling fantasies. Science suggests they believe them. And the most read piece on the Times website is Iran war latest. Tehran claims to have fired missiles at the US carrier. Now, US officials have not confirmed whether the USS Abraham Lincoln came under attack. That page is constantly being updated with the latest news from the conflict. And of course, you can read all those articles on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
So a 15-point US peace proposal has been delivered to Iran via Pakistan, according to the news agency Reuters. Donald Trump has repeatedly said talks between the two sides are ongoing, while Iran's military has denied that, saying the US president is just negotiating with himself. Israeli airstrikes on Iran are continuing, while Iranian missiles and drones have targeted Kuwait and Jordan today. Some Gulf states fear that if the US exits the war now, it could could end with an emboldened and more extreme Iranian government. The son of the country's last Shah, the exiled Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, is among those calling for Trump to ensure that full regime change does happen in Iran. Let's talk now to Justin Forsyth, who advises the Crown Prince. Justin, a very good afternoon from us. The war's side effects are still raging, aren't they? Higher oil prices, a slowdown in the global economy, inflation rising here. And that is also an aside when you look at the death and destruction and displacement going on. So why does Mr. Pahlavi believe that this should continue?
Well, before we had the military strikes, we had an uprising by people in Iran, millions of them, that led on the 8th and 9th of January for people in every province in Iran to come onto the streets and call for the end of this regime. Reza Pahlavi called for that to happen actually at a specific time on the 8th and 9th, and millions of people did. And then in the subsequent days, up to 40,000 people were killed. And you know, as a consequence of that, you know, the world looked at that but didn't act. President Trump and Israel did act, and they've, over the last few weeks, degraded the regime, not just killed a number of its leaders, but at a street level, they've killed these militias, the Basij. They've created some space for people who want to go out on the streets again at the right moment. Now, Reza Pahlavi has asked people not to go out at this moment, to wait for more action from the Israelis and the US to further degrade the regime. But at the right moment, he will. And that uprising, which is in effect the boots on the ground, the Iranian people, will overthrow this regime, combined with a number of people in the regime breaking ranks and defecting, but more importantly, large sections of the army. A lot of the military strikes have been specifically targeted at the Revolutionary Guards and the besieged, not the army. And large sections of the army will break ranks at the right moment and defend the people. So what we're asking President Trump to do at this moment is to continue what he is doing. It is working. I mean, I know that's not a popular view in the UK or in Europe, even in some parts of America, but the attacks and military strikes are actually working. They're creating the space, they're levelling the field, they're allowing at the right moment for the Iranian people to overthrow this regime.
What other evidence do you and Reza Pahlavi have that there still is on the ground this coherent movement that could secure control of a new government? Because I suppose, Justin, for many people, it's as simple as being able to see a face, to put a name to a face, to be able to identify someone who could then be a figurehead for a movement.
Well, the only name people called for in their tens of millions in January were Reza Pahlavi. Now, he leads a movement, he has a coalition of all the democratic forces, not just people that are monarchists, but Republicans, left, right, the tribal leaders across Iran, people in Iran and outside. He has a coalition that is very strong. He is the figurehead of that coalition. He is offering his leadership for the transition, but only until the point of elections, when the people of Iran would vote for a new government. And I think there's a huge unity in Iran behind that leadership. And we saw that on the 8th and 9th of January. You know, tens of millions came out in all 31 provinces because he called for it. He actually called for it at a specific time. And to the minute, millions came out on the street. So I think there's no question about his support and that leadership.
So can I just ask a question about that timeline, though? Because when President Trump then announced that he would be partaking in military action against Iran, and he called for the people to rise up and protest themselves, why wouldn't there been a more kind of coherent part played in all of that by Pahlavi if both of the aims seem to be quite similar?
Because President Trump didn't. That's a big misunderstanding. President Trump and actually the head of the CENTCOM, the US top military general, yesterday said he's asking people not to come out on the streets. Reza Pahlavi has deliberately asked people to stay at home at the moment until the right moment. Actually, President Trump also, the Prime Minister of Israel, said the same thing. There's been lots of messaging into Iran. Do not come out at the moment. We're degrading the security infrastructure. At the right moment, the Iranian people will come out again and they will have a shot at overthrowing this regime, combined with large bits of the security forces defecting and defending the people. Now, this isn't quite the right moment yet. We need further degradation on the ground. I mean, much of this isn't being reported. It's not just the killing of the leadership and the breakdown of the command and control structures of the arm of the security forces. It's at a street level, these militia besiege who man roadblocks in every township on streets are being attacked. And they've actually fled on these roadblocks now. Some of the streets are actually quite empty. There is space now for people to begin to protest again, but it's not quite there, and we need a bit more time before people can rise up again.
Where is Pahlavi realistically in any kind of pantheon of negotiation? Is he close to the main players at all?
Yes, he's talking to the US administration. He's talking to the Israelis. He's talking to European governments. But his real power is on the ground in Iran. Tens and tens of millions of people support him. You know, the American and Israeli actions can go so far. They can, they can help degrade the security forces. But in the end, the boots on the ground are the Iranian people. And his power is they follow him. Millions and millions of people do. And when he calls for them to come out, eventually they will. But we've got to do it so that 40,000 people don't get killed again. And so the we've got to judge the moment, or he's got to judge the moment rightly for that to have most impact. And we still need some more action from the US and Israel before that can happen.
Right. It's so difficult, isn't it? I mean, the whole situation is difficult, Justin, but trying to work out that kind of timing where the infrastructure is degraded enough for the current regime to be so weak that protests can turn into power, but also the infrastructure hasn't been degraded so much that really nobody can function within the country.
Well, actually, you know, if you ask Iranian people at the moment, they support the military strikes. There's lots and lots of reports of that. They don't believe they're targeted at them. They don't believe they'd be mainly targeted at infrastructure, with a few exceptions. But largely, they focus very much on the leadership of the regime and the security apparatus, not the economic or other infrastructure. A few exceptions, but in large part have focused in a very targeted way. And Iranian people really support that. There's been very little reporting of that. They also really support the US and the Israelis staying the course, giving them a chance at the right moment to be those boots on the ground to overthrow the regime. They've been waiting 47 years for this. This is a massive opportunity for change, given half a chance. And, you know, they're still reeling from 40,000 people being killed in January, literally in a few days. And we can't allow the remnants of this regime to survive. This is a chance for freedom, for democracy, for the Iranian people finally to have a chance at a better future. And I think it's important the world stands with the Iranian people in their hour of need. Hmm.
The Shah was toppled, his regime was unpopular, seen as cruel by so many people. So is there not a quite obvious feeling of uncertainty, an understandable feeling of uncertainty, for the Iranian people to embrace that man's son?
Well, I think the evidence is that they do. But he's his own man. He's a Democrat. He's not even fighting to be king or the monarch. He's saying, you know, there will be a democratic process, a constitutional process, where people will get to decide their constitution, but also the first elected government. He sees himself as a transitional leader. That's why so many groups, Republican, monarchist, right and left, tribal leaders, have come under his umbrella. He's the most well-known national figure who millions of people support. So he feels he has a duty of responsibility to step forward and lead the opposition through this transition to freedom and democracy. Ultimately, it will be up to the Iranian people to decide what type of democracy, but it will be a secular democracy. And it will also be an opportunity for Iranian people to finally be able to express their freedom, but also to become a normal country again. Actually, Iranians love the West. They are very interested in what's happening in Europe and America. They don't hate Israel like is reported, like the regime does. They would be able to bring peace to the region. There would be an end of supporting Hamas and Hezbollah and other proxies. There'd be an end of this fueling of extremism, which we're seeing on the streets of London at the moment. This would be a huge opportunity for the world. It's a country of 93 million people.
Sure, but isn't it quite naive, Justin, to think that a country of 93 million people would hold no place for those who do support Hamas or Hezbollah?
Well, this regime has about 15 or 20% of the people that support it, and they're armed and they are very ideological. But they're a remnant, and they do support Hamas and Hezbollah. But, you know, there's been a big backlash against extreme Islam in Iran. You know, the mosques are pretty empty. The huge numbers of people are not supporting the extremism of the government. They might be religious, but they're not supporting that extremism. So I don't think there is any support. You know, it's interesting at football games and other big public moments in Iran, when the regime tries to get people to chant in support of Hamas or Hezbollah, they actually chant against them. And so there is very little support for the government, the regime in Iran, or for their proxies like Hamas and Hezbollah in the region. This could be a massive opportunity for the world. And one of the reasons that President Zelensky has recently met Reza Pahlavi twice is because also Iran is fueling the war in Ukraine with drones. It's not just destabilizing the region. I mean, it's not even spreading terror in places like London and Paris and Berlin. It's also fueling a conflict in Ukraine. This is a huge opportunity. And it's very important that we stay the course, we bring down this regime, and we usher in a new opportunity. I know people fear that it could be like Iraq. That's what, you know, is in the back of people's mind. But Iran is actually very different. It's a very unified and very nationalistic country. The people are not anti-Western. And given half a chance, they'll play a full role in the international community.
The similarity, though, is that there may well be boots on the ground from a Western power. And many people would point to the lessons in Iraq and say, you can't expect a country to embrace Western democracy because you've got a military power breathing down its neck. It simply doesn't seem to work. Are you saying that Iran is so different to Iraq? We're all human beings on the planet, Justin, that that's something that nobody should be worried about.
Well, no, of course we should be worried about it. But if you want to follow what the Iranian people want, they want democracy and freedom. They are the ones that started this. They rose up at the end of last year, and then even in bigger numbers in January. They demanded their freedom. They're also, it's not like Iraq because, you know, there aren't these big divisions in the country. It is a homegrown revolution. And yes, America and Israel are now supporting that revolution, but nobody's asking for Israel or America to send boots on the ground. The Iranian people will be those boots on the ground, given half a chance. All they've asked for is a level playing field to give them a chance to bring down the regime. Now, you know, what's happened has really created an opportunity that those military strikes, which the Iranians don't see this as a war. They see this as a humanitarian rescue mission from 48 years of being held hostage by extremist ideologues who have oppressed them. And so all they're asking for is a bit more time, and then they'll rise up and bring down the regime. Hopefully, at the same time, large sections of the army and other parts of the security forces, and also people in the regime who've seen the light, will break ranks. There also will be no de-Ba'athification. Reza Pahlavi has said that large numbers of people in the civil service, even in the army, will be able to have a stake in the future of Iran.
Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. That's Justin Forsyth, who is an advisor to the son of the country's last Shah, Reza Pahlavi.
Coming up, why canine couture is being ousted from the world of high fashion. It's 2:22. This is Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
We'll bring you all the latest news and analysis from all around the world. It probably boils down, as ever, to one question. What on earth will Donald Trump say and do next?
The Sunday Times' Charlotte Ivers and the New Statesman's Will Lloyd will be here to talk through the biggest stories of the morning. Plus, we'll get the best letters to the Times from Andrew Riley.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Sorry to interrupt your day, but I've just been diagnosed with dementia, and I'm going to need your help. I'll need help when I can no longer button a shirt or recognise my own family. My daughter will need help too. I worry this could ruin her life. And we will all need help to find a cure to end the devastation of dementia. I can't do this alone.
It will take a society to beat dementia. Alzheimer's Society.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Save up to 50% on kitchen units with the Spend and Save offer. And for a limited time, there's an extra 10% off. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find your nearest kitchen showroom at wix.co.uk.
Do you normally listen to Times Radio at home? Well, you can listen in your car too and never miss a moment. If you've got a DAB radio in your car, you just need to search the dial for Times Radio. If you can't find it, you may need to rescan that radio. It doesn't take long. It usually works. I love that. If you need it, there are more instructions on the Times Radio website. And if you can't make it happen, I'll come round and try and do it for you. It took me about three goes in my car. I got there in the end. I've added some words to that. 24 minutes past two. Superb.
I think the Queen of Pop would approve of that. Well, it's a dog-eat-dog world at the top of the Glossy magazine game. Ah, that's the lesson being learned by the team at Dogue, a magazine full of comic photos of our canine friends. Now, they're being sued by Vogue, a fashion magazine full of serious pictures of humans, on the grounds they're doing something irreparable damage to its brand. Well, Ollie Port is the editor-in-chief of Dogue and joins us from Los Angeles. Ollie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that specially crafted intro that we had made there for in honour of
I
Dogue.
Love it.
Good. We did too. Tell us a little bit more about Dogue. I mean, a lot of our listeners won't have heard of it. What is it? When did it begin? How often does it come out and who's it for?
Yes. So I started it in 2019 as a passion project inspired by my own dog, Mimi Bear, a Pomeranian that I adopted in 2016. I started an Instagram account for her. I started sharing really cute pictures of her in clothes because, well, I just couldn't help it. It made me so happy. And I wanted to share that joy with the others. And then that's when I got introduced to the amazing world of Instagram dogs. Mm. And I noticed that they were putting out amazing content, but there was no platform that celebrated them. And so that's where the idea of Cover Dogs was born. Cover Dogs is a play on cover girls. And the idea was to feature dogs as the models of fashion and the stars of pop culture.
I love it. Now, for our
And from there, Dogue magazine was born.
For our listeners, Ollie, who might not have seen all the fabulous pictures that I have researching this, tell me, what kind of clothes do you put Mimi Bear and other cover stars in?
Yeah, so, I mean, for me, because I have a Pomeranian, now again, I have Maui. Unfortunately, Mimi Bear is no longer with us.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But Pomeranians, thank you. Pomeranians are so fluffy that I don't really dress her up that much because she just doesn't need it. So, you know, I would put like sweaters on her when it was chilly outside sometimes, raincoats when it was raining. And every time we would go out to a doggy event, we would match. Hmm. However, the models of our community are exceptional at dressing. They have these full-on outfits. We're talking about cuffs that are actually custom-made by our own in-house designer, Shannon Cooper. She's a Dogue stylist. They also have custom clothes that are also made by our in-house fashion designer, Michelle Harper.
Mm.
And then every month I come up with fashion editorial collections that are designer inspired, like Versace, Sniffany, Palentino, and so forth.
So not too dissimilar to some of the work that Vogue does. Tell us, why is Vogue, which is the sort of fashion bible, why is it taking legal action against you and Dogue?
I mean, it really came as a shock to me as well. And I believe that the reason that they're opposing this is because they want to do it themselves.
Oh, interesting. You think they're, they're jealous of what Dogue has started, Dogue Mania?
I don't know if they're jealous. They're just maybe jealous that they haven't thought of it first, because we started this in 2019. And then in 2024, Vogue decided to do a dog vertical, starting from digital. And now it's also becoming print, as they have just launched in December the first edition of Dogue magazine in print in Vogue Thailand. Oh. So yeah, they started 5 years after us, and I feel like they do want to expand this in the US as well. But because I have a trademark for it, you know, it's kind of stopping them from doing that. And when I say I have a trademark, I mean it was already filed and approved, but because Vogue is opposing it, it's currently, you know, suspended. The full registration is suspended.
So, Ollie, presumably you're standing your ground on this and want to keep publishing Dogue. What happens if you lose and you have to rebrand?
That's a really good question. So if I do lose, I don't think that they'll be able to stop me from using the name Dogue, because it is a parody and parodies are legal. So what I can lose is the trademark. And that would mean that Vogue would be able to do their own Dogue simultaneously as me. And that would, of course, not be good for me, because it's only going to be a matter of time before they completely overshadow us and delete us.
Do you think Vogue have slightly overreacted for this? I mean, how many readers do you have? Have they overreacted on you just having a bit of fun with dogs and fashion?
Yes, absolutely. We're very, very small, especially comparing to somebody like Vogue. The community is very shocked. And if anything, I mean, I think once they released their own Dogue campaign, we all expected that this would lead to a partnership of some sort, but not a lawsuit.
So you would ideally like to be working with Vogue, not doing legal battle with them?
I used to. Right now, I'm not sure that would be the case. I mean, I did offer them partnership before the lawsuit.
Well, a spokesperson for Condé Nast told People magazine that they made several attempts to resolve the issue with Dogue amicably before filing the lawsuit, stating, "Protecting the work of our writers, photographers and creative teams, as well as our intellectual property, is a responsibility we take seriously." And we will watch to see how Vogue versus Dogue develops. That was Ollie Port, who's the Dogue editor-in-chief.
I think it's, I mean, I can see where it all is in the legal spectrum. I just think it's incredibly humourless in
Vogue.
Human spectrum. Yes,
I agree.
Completely.
Worth to that.
Yeah. And also, don't patronise us. We can tell the difference between Dogue and Vogue.
You
don't think we're okay. Thank you. Yes, again. Oh, we should say that was made by Hannah Quinn, our producer this afternoon. Absolutely fantastic work. And that's what she went to journalism school for. It's just gone 2:30. Coming up, why is a British 16-year-old stranded in Denmark and unable to get home? Let's get the latest news headlines with Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, V. Good afternoon. Police have said two men arrested over an arson attack on a Jewish ambulance service in Golders Green are both British nationals. The men, aged 47 and 45, were arrested on suspicion of arson with intent to endanger life at separate addresses in northwest and central London on Wednesday morning. Iranian state media is calling Donald Trump's 15-point peace plan excessive, adding it'll end the war at a time of its choosing. The US president alleged yesterday Tehran's agreed to never have a nuclear weapon. The exiled crown prince, Reza Pahlavi, is among those calling for Trump to ensure full regime change in Iran. Justin Forsyth advises the crown prince.
A lot of the military strikes have been specifically targeted at the Revolutionary Guards and the besieged, not the army. And large sections of the army will break ranks at the right moment and defend the people. So what we're asking President Trump to do at this moment is to continue what he is doing. I mean, I know that's not a popular view in the UK or in Europe, but the attacks and military strikes are actually working. They're creating the space, they're levelling the field, they're allowing at the right moment for the Iranian people to overthrow this regime.
The health secretary says it's not good enough. An NHS trust in Kent took 26 hours to report a suspected meningitis case 2 weeks ago. It's one of five hospital groups at the bottom of league tables placed under an intensive recovery programme. And there's a new man in charge at the BBC. Incoming Director General Matt Britton is a former Google boss and will take home a salary of £565,000. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please, go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Save up to 50% on kitchen units with the Spend and Save offer. And for a limited time, there's an extra 10% off. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find your nearest kitchen showroom at wix.co.uk.
Edward says if Doug doesn't work out, you could have Harper's Bazaar as an alternative.
Oh, I like what he's done there.
Very good. Tony says there's a French dog called Doug. Oh, we're going to go and search that out. And Tom says 12 out of 10 to the producer there. Absolutely. John Pienaar joins us. Hello, John.
Hello, hello.
Where are you going to start at 4 o'clock?
So I'm going to be looking at this report on political interference from abroad and talking to the author of the report, Sir Philip Rycroft, on what to do about that. And it involves a lot of proposals, including banning the use of cryptocurrency to make political donations and putting people on guard against interference from outside foreign influence. And it's maybe over time for this to be talked about. We've known about Russia, China, the potential adversaries. America now is very open about the way that it wants to interfere in politics around Europe, including here, promoting the insurgent parties on the right of politics against the mainstream and doing that very, very openly. So here we've got a set of proposals. And what does it mean for us here? So talking about that, obviously talking about Iran, the 15-point plan that we're hearing about now being sort of picked up across the American media and elsewhere. There is a 15-point plan. And I'm talking to Richard Spencer about the plan, whether it's got a chance of making any progress, and also to a former State Department official. Is there any hope or prospect of any kind of breakthrough? And saying this, even as thousands of American paratroopers and US Marines are making their way to the area to intervene, well, who knows how? Are we talking about an invasion of this much-discussed Karg Island, the energy centre? Could that tip the balance? Could it be the beginning of a quagmire, just a massive entanglement? And also going to be talking about the capybara. Don't think it's got a name, this creature, has it? What has it?
Yes, it's called Samba.
It's called Samba, is
yes.
it?
Yes.
Okay. So talking about Samba.
Samba's a she.
And what he's up to. Is it a she? Yes. It's a she.
Yes, Tom.
Okay, but apparently it's in Hampshire, heading towards residential areas. Do you like capybara? It's not that you would have thought of that much, I would have thought.
No. We went to, I think it was Pisa. Was it Pisa? On holiday. And in the river, we thought we were watching the beautiful sight of a wild otter at play. So we filmed it on our cameras, swimming all the way up. It got to the bank, it got out, and it was a great big capybara. And it's just
a native to Italy,
huge
then?
Rat. That's what it is.
You weren't moved by a bit of
affection. No.
They're revered
really
in Japan, though, apparently. Our producer, Rosie, was showing me pictures of capybaras bathing with lemons in Japan.
Okay, Girona, that's where we were. Sorry, I had a temporary mini break
memory
loss.
They're native to South America, apparently. No.
Yeah.
Do they eat them in Japan?
Couldn't possibly comment, John. I don't know.
I don't know. Right.
I hope not.
Anyway, you can tell that I've got to do some homework on capybara.
No, I think you should just go in with the questions without knowing very much. I think it's much better for you. Much more fun for us. Thank you very much. John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. We got a little bit overhooked on the story of Samba yesterday. I can't believe she's been out in the wild now for nearly 3 days.
She's a survivor fee.
I don't think she does want to go back. I don't think she wants to get caught. Oh!
She's made a bid for freedom.
Oh, word. Let's take a closer look at one of the regional winners in this year's Sunday Times Best Places to Live, sponsored by Lloyds.
The Sunday Times Best Places to Live on Times Radio, sponsored by Lloyds. Spotlight on Scotland. Winner, Aberfeldy, Perthshire.
I'm Zanna Wilson. We lived in Edinburgh for a long time, and then when we were having children, we moved back to Aberfeldy. We are a diverse community now, lots of different nationalities, professions, ages. I've noticed in 18 years of living here how lively it's become.
My name's Ian Black. Do you retire here? Lots of arty people here. There's an art classes, painting, pottery. So it's a community that there's Highland dancing. We all... There's a big ball every year at Blair Castle from Aberfeldy, so there's a big group of dancers. So you get to know people through all these clubs and activities. And if you're into, you know, keep fit, there's, you know, lots to do with swimming, canoeing, climbing, cycling. Right? And there's lots of arts happen here too, you know, in the local cinema especially. It gets, you know, like I say, J.K. Rowling lives across, or has a holiday place across the river. So, you know, there's activities going on all the time.
Apart from 7 years when I was away from home, I've lived here all my life. I was born and bred here. Absolutely adore it. Every day I get up and give thanks that I'm living here. I definitely love looking at mountains, and we're surrounded with them. And the community spirit's wonderful in Aberfeldy, and old people especially are so well catered for. There's so many organisations run by voluntary groups, people giving their time when they could be doing things that they wanted to enjoy themselves, but they don't look after the old people. So we're very, very lucky. It's always been like this in Aberfeldy. It's always been a beautiful little town.
And there's a coffee shop culture as well. You know, it's quite a nice little village. And I like it, or we like it, because of the community that Norman talked about. But because you've got these different layers, it's mixed from the locals that have been here for years. You know, they say, you're not a local unless you know somebody in the graveyard.
That was a quick look at Aberfeldy, this year's winner for Scotland in the Sunday Times Best Places to Live, sponsored by Lloyds.
The Sunday Times Best Places to Live on Times Radio, sponsored by Lloyds. Spotlight on Scotland. Winner, Aberfeldy, Perthshire.
A 16-year-old British girl has been stranded in Denmark for nearly 3 weeks, despite promises of help from the Home Office. The Times reports the girl travelled on her Norwegian passport, but new rules demand that as a British citizen, she uses a British passport to return. That's something she currently doesn't have, and her family say the embassy and government haven't helped. Monique Hawkins is head of policy and advocacy for the 3 Million, a grassroots organisation for EU citizens in the UK. And Monique's in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in. Monique, just remind us about these new changes to the rules and what they mean.
Yeah, so really the change that's come in is the full enforcement of ETAs, which are the UK's electronic travel authorisation. And that those ETAs are meant for visitors who come to the UK, but they have a side effect on everyone else who isn't a visitor. So we've been campaigning for more visibility for people who actually, foreigners who live here and have an immigration status, but also dual nationals who now have to come in on their British passport, even if until a few weeks ago they were still able to travel in on their other passport.
And what was the reason for the change to the rules, and why did the Home Office decide they wanted to do this?
Well, I think the Home Office has long been wanting to make everything digital. They want full control. They want to push the border outwards. They want to stop people even reaching the UK border and be prevented from boarding while abroad. And I just think there's lots of cohorts that they've overlooked in there.
And on a sort of day-to-day basis, what does that mean for people who have dual citizenship? Are they finding it increasingly hard to come and go freely?
Absolutely. I mean, it's even for people who have both passports, like myself, it has the practical side of it has become more and more difficult. Like when I travel to the EU and back, I do have both passports, but I have to be continually juggling them both and showing the right one when going to the EU and then the other one coming back. And that's a problem because a lot of carriers don't let you switch documents halfway. In my case, even more difficult. My names are different on both of them. But now the UK is absolutely insisting that you travel back on their UK passport, whereas before February, they were a bit more flexible about it.
Did they advertise or sort of, you know, make people enough aware that these changes were coming in, or have people been caught on the hop?
I think people have been caught on the hop. I mean, the Home Office defence is that they've been advertising it on their website since last November or something.
Not everyone's looking at that, are they?
Well, exactly. It's just buried somewhere. And I mean, this is especially harsh for people who live abroad, especially, for example, children who are happen to be British because they've got a British father, but they don't live here at all. For them, it's now incredibly difficult to travel to the UK. We've had a lot of people contacting us in that situation, and they certainly wouldn't be checking Home Office websites every day to see if any corners of it changed.
I mean, most people wouldn't. With this specific case, I mean, it's awful that a 16-year-old girl is stuck not at home. Why is she and her family having so much trouble getting back?
Well, that's a very good question. I really would have thought it would have been very, very easy to come back. Well, one of the things we've called for is a very speedy and cheap sort of emergency authorisation. When Canada introduced its scheme 10 years ago, they did exactly that. They recognised that despite all the comms they'd done on it, that there would always be people caught out. So they've put in place that for $7 Canadian, you can get a single trip emergency authorisation. And we've asked the UK to do that and they've refused.
What? Have they given any reason for refusing?
Only that this is all in line with their stated policy and they announced it a long time ago. I mean, the letter just doubles down on all their position. It's very, very frustrating.
Well, that is the 3 million grassroots organisation which can help people stuck in this situation find more help. We should say that a Home Office spokesperson said about this case, "We're aware of this case and we're working at pace to provide assistance. Public information advising dual nationals to travel with a valid UK passport or certificate of entitlement has been available since October 2024, including official guidance on gov.uk. Guidance for dual citizens was also included in our ETA communications campaign, which has been running since 2023. Clearly not very successfully, though.
Not really, no. No. Can I just ask Monique, is there ever a case now where a human can, you know, at border control, make a decision themselves? Or is part of the problem here that we are so automated in our systems, there is now no longer any room for manoeuvre?
Well, the real problem is that airlines get fined, massive fines, for every person they transport to the UK who's then not allowed in. So they've become incredibly risk averse. And there is a 24/7 helpline called the Carrier Support Hub that the UK Home Office operates that carriers can call. But as even the Home Office admits, they can't mandate carriers to use that. It's only optional if they want to do that to reassure themselves to avoid the fine. But a lot of carriers are simply just not taking the risk and just saying, if you haven't got the right document that we want, then sorry, you're not coming in.
Right. Gosh, that explains a lot, actually. I have seen, whilst boarding an airport myself, people being turned away at the gate because they have passport difficulties. And I did think, gosh, you know, in 40 years of travelling, I'd never seen that happening. But that really explains it. If it's going to be on the airline, suddenly there's another level that you have to go through, isn't there?
Exactly.
Well, personal experience on this would be very valuable. If you've got any stories that you'd like to tell us about falling into exactly this particular hole, we would love to hear them, Jane and Fee at times.radio. Coming up, we're going to talk telly. It is 13 minutes to three. You're listening to Roy, Anika and Fee Glover on Times Radio. We're with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Listen to Times Radio every night from 10 for a first take on the stories making the headlines. Plus, explore the wider news agenda with thought-provoking guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. It's your dream nightly destination for the finest mix of news, culture and conversation. Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Explore, plan and now book the perfect holiday inspired by the journalists you trust. Search Times Holidays.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
Cathay Pacific brings you closer to Asia. From Hanoi's vibrant streets to Bali's serene shores, indulge in world-class service, savour Michelin star dining, and lose yourself in our award-winning in-flight entertainment. Cathay Pacific. Move beyond.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Now, I tell you what, here at Times Towers, all members of presenter staff need an away day to get our facts right about large rodents. Grant says those would have been koipu in Italy, not capybara.
Who knew?
My learning curve is steep. Matt Britton, a former Google executive, has just been confirmed as the new Director General of the BBC. Let's talk about that and loads of other TV stuff with our favourite and the best TV critic, Scott Bryan. Hello, Scott.
Hello, lovely to see you.
Well, very nice to see you, very nice to hear you. So the first thing that people want to say about Matt Britton is that he's not a journalist. He has not worked in television or audio. He comes from the world of tech. What do you make of his appointment?
I mean, not that surprising, really. I mean, his name has been in the news for the last few days. It was reported at the weekend that he was likely to be Director General. So this seems to be more of a confirmation than anything. I mean, he's certainly got an interesting track record. You know, head of Google UK, very well known within tech, has been very keen on public service broadcasting and has wanted to for some time to make his way into TV. But you're right in terms of the fact that, you know, this is a point where you would normally expect there to be somebody who has had many years in TV broadcasting to be heading up this job. I think the pros with him being in this role was, you know, the BBC is at a crossroads where it's trying to work out how does it embrace how our streaming habits are changing, how we're all watching content now on YouTube. So who better to go and run the BBC than somebody who has had years within that sector? But I think the real risk is, as we all know, the BBC has been thrown into quite a few controversies over the last few years. And you need to have somebody who has got editorial experience to navigate choppy waters, because you can be turning up to your office on Monday and then by Tuesday afternoon, you're dealing with a whole crisis about a certain report in the news or something to do with what aired during the weekend. And you have to react quickly. Now, in the announcement today, they announced that there's going to be a deputy director general, perhaps taking off the heat off Matt's forthcoming role. And I would reckon that there would be somebody who would have, you know, years in editorial guidance to go maybe take that role on. I mean, in my view, I think the role of DG is so wide, it has to cover so much that it can be seen to be a bit of a kind of really, you know, arduous job. It's a it's a significant job in British media, but I think it's certainly at the moment one of the most perilous.
Yes, and when it goes wrong, it goes really, really wrong, doesn't it? I absolutely hear you on that point about being able to refer to other people's experience editorially. But the thing is, Scott, that if you're the Director General, you've got a whole building of editors and journalists and people with experience in news. So I find that just a slightly kind of, I don't know, I always find it slightly odd that people want to think that that's irrelevant.
I can see your point. I mean, I think that what I can see being a real challenge for the BBC is not really always being quick enough in a crisis. I mean, I found that with, for example, the BAFTA film situation, you know, it was reported in regards to the BAFTA Film Awards were still up 16 hours after, you know, what happened during that ceremony took place. So many people could still see it before the BBC took it down. And I think it's a challenge for the BBC is when there is a crisis, can it ensure that it doesn't snowball? Because, as you know, the coverage these days run, you know, in terms of people reporting on things, it's a bit like politics. It changes by the hour. And sometimes I think to myself, it's a bit of a surprise when the BBC, which essentially should know how to broadcast itself, doesn't always react as quickly as you think it would during a crisis.
Absolutely. Let's talk about some really sad news that came through yesterday. Married at First Sight star Mel Schilling died at the age of 54. Her family said she was surrounded by love following a battle with colon cancer. For people who hadn't ever caught her on Married at First Sight Australia or the UK version, she was such a pleasure to watch, Scott, wasn't she?
She was very much, I think, the heart of the reason why that show worked with so many viewers. I mean, she's been remembered as being really kind of full of warmth. I think the term, you know, lights up the room can be thrown about a bit, but I think that was certainly true with what I've seen about people's kind of tributes to her. And it was certainly the case in that programme. I mean, she was giving relationship advice to people who might feel a little bit lost in love. And I think she's been referred to as the queen of reality TV. And I do think that is the case with her.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she's also been incredibly open, you know, in regards to her experiences with cancer over the course of the last 2 years. And I think one part of her legacy, as well as, of course, her entertainment, you know, being sort of a firm favourite on many people's TV sets that will be much missed, is her kind of awareness in terms of cancer and screening.
Absolutely. She'll be much, much missed in our household. Let's discuss briefly Mr. Nobody Against Putin, which won this year's Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. You can see it now. It's up on Netflix, I think, isn't it?
It
shows a Russian teacher risking everything to expose propaganda in his classroom. What did you think of it, Scott?
I mean, I think it's fantastic. It was also on the BBC sort of on their Storyville strand, which is available on BBC Four for quite a long time. So I saw it a few months ago. And I think the one reason why it works is that it's just the person being at the right place at the right time. Essentially, at the outbreak of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, he was told you have to be essentially filming a lot of basically essentially what is propaganda. And then he was documenting it and kind of highlighting about the messages coming from above about how essentially they're trying to sort of teach a whole lot of school kids one line of kind of what's been said by the Russian government, that he believed that it wasn't actually true. And then it then documents his eventual escape from the country. I mean, I found his bravery in terms of able to be documenting this fantastic. It's one of those documentaries that really sort of throws you in on the personal aspects of it too. And I think also kind of a grounded reflection of what it was like from the Russian perspective at the side of start of the war, which you don't really tend to see.
Yeah, we are bidding to have Pavel Talikin Pasha, the teacher in the film, on the show and the podcast sometime over the coming weeks. Yep. I can't wait to meet him. I very much hope that one comes off. Claudia Winkleman has been facing a little bit of criticism over her new chat show. I mean, it is early days, isn't it, Scott?
It is. I mean, I always feel sorry for new shows, particularly when it comes to chat shows, because I find that critics are really out for it. One gripe I hate is when those news websites take like three tweets or three things on Blue Sky and then use it to sort of argue a case. And there's certainly been a lot of, people aren't fond of Claudia's show by not that much social media reaction. I mean, I think it takes a while for a show to bed in anyway. I found the second episode better than the first episode of Claudia Winkleman's show. Of course, it's the same team who do the Graham Norton show, multiple people on at the same time, fair bit of audience reaction. I think it will take some time for the show to find its own footing. But I find that these days, particularly when it comes to personality-led formats, there isn't that much of an opportunity for them to find their groove, whilst before the age of social media, or when there were far fewer channels, TV bosses would at least give a 10, 20 episode run, or maybe multiple series, in the hope that it will find its place before cancellation. I think Claudia is doing an okay job so far. It might not be as seamless as Graham's, but I mean, Graham has been doing it for well over a decade.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just get what you expect, really, from that sofa chat. The downfall of Hugh Edwards sees Martin Clunes portray the newsreader through the fallout of his horrible grooming scandal. It's on Channel 5, isn't it? Hugh Edwards himself has had quite a lot to say about this, which is just giving it an absurd amount of publicity, actually, isn't it, Scott?
It is. I mean, he said that he hadn't been approached in terms of giving his side of the story. I think the people who made this show said, well, I mean, they followed the Ofcom code in their view, and also they went by court transcripts, interviews with the victims, and published accounts. I've seen the factual drama. It didn't do that badly, actually, for Channel 5. I think it's one of Channel 5's most popular programmes this year so far. About 1.5 million people have seen it. I think there's been quite a lot of talk about whether it was too soon, but I think what I found a strength of the series, or of the one-part drama last night, was how factual it was, and it went into a lot of details that I had actually seen previously reported, rather than a lot of it being, you know, essentially just speculation. I think Hugh has said he's going to give his side of the story at one point, but I mean, I think from seeing it personally, I don't really want to hear his side of his account, because it's already so incredibly damning from just seeing the Channel 5 docudrama.
Yes, I mean, I think he is trying to say that mental illness is misunderstood, but I think 99.9% of people listening to your wise words there, Scott, will probably agree that we don't really need to hear much more of that. And I know that quite a few people have been absolutely horrified at the implication that that has for other people who've got mental health difficulties. Thank you very much indeed, Scott. We will talk to you again next week. We were talking about Claudia Winkleman's chat show, The Downfall of Hugh Edwards, on Channel 5. And that amazing film is called Mr. Nobody Against Putin. You can see it now. It's up on Netflix. It is originally part of the BBC Storyville platform.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio. Still to come, we'll speak to mother about her battle for the truth over her daughter's fatal shooting by her father in the US. How are Ipswich fans reacting to the club's apparent support of Nigel Farage? Bassos Alexander will be here. And today's big guest is Thangnam Debonair, sharing the shortlist for the Women's Prize for Nonfiction. First, latest news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, Roy. Good afternoon. It's emerged Morgan McSweeney didn't tell the police who he was or that he worked at Number 10 when he reported that his phone had been stolen. The Prime Minister's former chief of staff contacted 999 in October last year and reported that a government device had been stolen. He said he gave chase, but the thief got away. There are concerns that key exchanges relating to Lord Peter Mandelson's appointment as US ambassador could have been on the device, which was reported stolen 1 month after Mandelson's sacking and was not backed up on WhatsApp. Health Secretary Wes Streeting says he understands why some would have cynicism, but he does not suspect deceit. Police have confirmed the nationality of two men arrested over an arson attack on Jewish ambulances in North London on Monday. They're aged 45 and 47 and are both British nationals. Two addresses are being searched. Iranian state media is calling Donald Trump's 15-point peace plan excessive, adding it'll end the war at a time of its own choosing. The US president alleged yesterday Tehran's agreed to never have a nuclear weapon. The son of the country's last Shah, the exiled crown prince Reza Pahlavi, is among those calling for Trump to continue dismantling the regime's security. Justin Forsyth advises the crown prince and says the conflict won't resemble what happened in Iraq if it continues.
The Iranians don't see this as a war. They see this as a humanitarian rescue mission. All they're asking for is a bit more time, and then they'll rise up and bring down the regime. Hopefully, at the same time, large sections of the army and other parts of the security forces, and also people in the regime who've seen the light, will break ranks.
Meanwhile, the chief executive of Shell, Wael Sawan, says Europe could face a shortage of energy and fuel as soon as next month without a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. The health secretary is demanding answers from an NHS trust that failed to report a suspected case of meningitis on time. Wes Streeting says East Kent hospitals took 26 hours to notify authorities when a patient was admitted a fortnight ago. But he's confident it's not hampered efforts to contain the outbreak and has praised the remarkable efforts from health staff.
We saw the rapid stand-up of contact tracing, the rapid stand-up of antibiotics distribution, the rapid stand-up of a vaccination programme, and we've continued to follow the evidence and take swift and necessary action.
Hundreds of young people in Britain will take part in a trial looking at the impact screen time has on things like schoolwork and sleep. Teenagers are testing out social media bans, while others will face time limits and curfews. It's part of a government consultation looking into a potential blanket ban for under-16s. Jennifer Powers from the Unplugged Coalition, which supports this, thinks we need to change society for young people.
We set social norms. We set rules about what's acceptable and what's safe for kids. And I really think we need to reset cultural norms to say that smartphones are devices for adults and these social media platforms are activity for adults.
And a former boss at Google is replacing Tim Davie as the Director General of the BBC. Matt Britton, who's 57, was Google's president in Europe, the Middle East and Africa when he left last year. The former BBC boss Tim Davie announced he was stepping down last November following a row about how Donald Trump's speech was edited on Panorama. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It is 4 minutes past three. Fee Glover and Ryan Nika with you for the next hour of Times Radio's magnificent output. We'll talk to Vassos the Great about sport in about 15 minutes' time. After 3:30, we're going to talk about all of the books that have been on the shortlist for the Women's Prize for Nonfiction. Some of them you will have heard the authors here on Times Radio already, in particular The Finest Hotel in Kabul, A People's History of Afghanistan by Lise Doucette. She was on our programme late last year. And Hotel Exile, Paris in the Shadow of War by Jane Rogoiska. I remember hearing that interview and I couldn't get out of the car until it had finished because it was so great. So stay with us until 4 o'clock. If you can, we're 0333 003 2353. If you'd like to get in touch, anything that we're talking about, we love to hear your thoughts. Now, in January last year, Lucy Harrison, a 23-year-old British woman, travelled to Texas to visit her family. She was shot in her father's home shortly before she was due to fly back to the UK. In the United States, no charges were brought after a grand jury declined to indict. The shooting was treated as accidental. But here in the UK, a coroner has since reached a very different conclusion, ruling that Lucy was unlawfully killed and that her death was the result of reckless actions. That stark contrast has left her family searching for answers and pushing for the case to be looked at again. Well, yesterday, Jane spoke to Lucy's mother, Jane Coates, and asked her what the findings of the inquest in this country mean for her family.
When we finally, you know, after a year and a month of, you know, since Lucy's death, when we finally heard that outcome, it was a relief in terms of Lucy's truth was finally out, because for so long, you know, we'd had to follow due process and we had to allow that to happen in America and then, you know, working towards the inquest. So for us, yeah, Lucy's truth we felt was finally out there, but for us, it still doesn't mean she's had justice, because a coroner's court is not a criminal court and so there can be no real blame attached. So for us, as far as we are aware at the moment, even though it was an unlawful killing conclusion, there's no consequences for Lucy's dad.
What are you able to tell us about what happened in the home of Lucy's father that day?
So she had been playing in the snow with her younger sisters. Sam, who's Lucy's partner, he'd gone out there too, along with Lucy's dad. And then eventually they all came in. And Lucy and Sam were due to fly back on that day. I received a text from Lucy to say she was all packed up and they were ready to come home.
Yeah.
They were ready to come home.
Yeah.
And within 15 minutes of that text, she had been shot. She had gone into the bedroom, which was on the ground floor, with her dad. Sam, in his witness statement to the police, said that he saw Lucy's dad take Lucy by the hand and he led her into the ground floor bedroom. They were laughing and joking. And within, I don't know, 20 seconds of them being in the room, Sam heard a bang. Well, he heard a loud noise. He didn't know it was a gunshot. And then very quickly went in and saw that Lucy was on the floor. But he wasn't aware of what happened at that moment. And I think when we were in the inquest and the coroner, you know, shared all the evidence, it was very clear that Lucy's dad had told his wife that the gun had gone off when they went into the room. But it was clear from Sam's 911 call that that information hadn't been relayed to Sam for quite a number of minutes. And he was very confused as to what had happened.
So people in Britain will really want to know what the investigation in the States was like. What happened?
I can say that I found out about Lucy's shooting approximately 5 to 6 hours after she was shot. It was actually Sam's mum that knocked on my door about 2 o'clock in the morning. So the Prosper Police Department had decided that the best way for me to, you know, be told this news was through Sam's mum, which Sam was concerned about because he just thought that they would have contacted the Foreign Office and the Foreign Office would have contacted Cheshire Constabulary. But that's not what happened. And then within an hour of Sam's mum, you know, being with me, I spoke to a detective and the detective had said that it was being treated as an accidental discharge. From there on in, I think our complete frustration and confusion with the investigation. So the fact of, you know, they had decided this before even Lucy had had her medical examination, which, so Lucy was shot on the Friday and her medical examination, you know, didn't take place until the Monday. And, you know, without even seeing her wound and seeing the, you know, the medical examination outcomes and conclusions, it was decided very, very quickly that it was an accidental discharge. Then the more we kind of found out, there was very, very limited information. We didn't actually get to speak to a first prosecutor for the district attorney until the 14th of February. So, you know, almost 5 weeks after Lucy's death. And it was only then we started to have a bit more information. And they told us that a responding officer had smelt alcohol on Lucy's dad's breath. And he then, when he was asked about whether he had been drinking initially, he said he hadn't, but he drank the previous day. And then when the officer said, well, I can smell alcohol on your breath, he then changed his account and said that, yes, he had been drinking since, well, before the girls woke up in the morning. And then it was found that he had gone to a 7-Eleven on CCTV that morning, approximately 2 hours before the shooting, and he purchased two further cartons of 500 millilitres cartons of wine, and yet he wasn't breathalysed. And we just find that totally incredulous and just can't understand why on earth he wasn't breathalysed at the scene.
Yes, I mean, this illustrates the vast cultural differences, doesn't it, between Texas and Cheshire. These are just very, very different worlds. And it'll be frustrating for you, and I've no doubt to many people listening to this, that, well, you tell me, do the British authorities have any rights at all here to investigate this as a potential criminal act?
That was what was hugely, hugely frustrating and confusing as well, because when the Foreign Office got involved, it was literally to kind of liaise and facilitate with Lucy's repatriation. In terms of the investigation, they said they had no jurisdiction whatsoever to investigate. And therefore, you know, the Foreign Office and the consulate staff member over in Texas, Houston, was just there to provide information, which, again, we didn't feel like, well, they didn't provide timely information, because it was only until we had reached out ourselves to be able to speak to the district attorney to be able to get any kind of information about, you know, what a grand jury was, because Lucy's case was referred to the grand jury. We didn't know what that was.
Yeah, just to explain, I didn't know either, but it's a group of civilians who look at the facts of the case and then decide what happens next.
It is, yeah, but it's very much guided by the prosecutor. So the prosecutor, you know, for the district attorney, looks at all the evidence, they look at the threshold, and then they, you know, they support the grand jury in reaching a verdict whether to indict or not, right. You know, whether to prosecute or not. My understanding is it's very much like a rubber stamp in terms of if the prosecutor feels that this isn't going to get, you know, to the threshold of charging, then, you know, they advise the grand jury to not to indict. But the grand jury happens in secret, and we don't know exactly what evidence was presented to the grand jury. And yeah, so the Foreign Office, you know, so they said that, you know, they couldn't, they've got no jurisdiction. But I did have a meeting with the Foreign Office, because I was really concerned about the lack of support that I felt we had. And following on from that meeting, I was given a lengthy letter, which in some aspects they did apologise and said that they should have done better. And in others, they said, you know, the only way that UK police could get involved is if it's a particularly complex case, which in the same letter, they actually called Lucy's case very uniquely complex. We did try and contact then on the 13th of February. Well, we did actually reach out to a detective from the Prosper Police Department, and we raised our concerns. And then after that conversation, there was a meeting with the Foreign Office and the National Crime Agency, in which then information was relayed back to us that if we wanted to raise any further concerns, we had to go through Interpol, which you can imagine, I'm still in shock. I'm still trying to, I can't really process the fact that Lucy had been killed. It just didn't make any sense to me. And then telling a bereaved mum that I had to go through Interpol, and there was no advocate for us. We didn't have any victim support. Victim support wasn't given. So it was just utterly confusing and frustrating.
Jane, I'm so sorry. I mean, this is just a dreadful, dreadful experience to even attempt to make sense of. So as far as you know, and don't answer this if you don't want to, Lucy's father is... he's still at home with his family and presumably still has his gun.
The last time I asked about, you know, whether or not he had a gun, it was my understanding that the gun was at the Prosper Police Department. But it's also my understanding that because, you know, he wasn't charged legally, you know, within Texas Penal Code, he is still legally able to own a gun for self-defence. So... Which again is just incredulous that the law allows somebody to still own a firearm for self-defence when somebody has been shot and killed in their home.
What next for you then, Jane? And I appreciate that you are doing what you're doing in the spirit of your daughter, and you are just determined to get justice for her. Everybody listening will understand that. But what can you do next?
Well, we've been supported by my local MP, and we are hoping to launch a campaign to raise more and more awareness of what's happened to Lucy. And, you know, I really thank the opportunity for you to let me come on and share, you know, with your listeners, because I've been that parent where I've sat and listened to radio podcasts and watched bereaved parents on the sofa, and you just think it never ever happens to you, because of course why would you ever think anything like this would happen to you? But for me, this is my life to bear, and so yeah, I've got to do everything that I can to try and get some kind of justice. And I don't know what that justice is going to look like. I don't know whether, you know, we can put pressure on, you know, whether we can put diplomatic pressure to get a case reopened over in the US. But also, I do want to work, you know, with the Foreign Office to ensure that bereaved families are better supported if something ever was to happen like this again, because what we received wasn't good enough. I also, I actually had a really emotional moment yesterday. I went online and watched Jess Phillips, Member of Parliament, speaking about women and girls abuse, and she read the names of, you know, women who had allegedly been killed by men over the last year, and Lucy's name was on that list. So I watched that yesterday, and it just felt so surreal hearing and seeing my daughter's name being uttered in Parliament. And I actually emailed Jess this morning. I wanted her to know that that mattered. You know, it really mattered to me. And just you know, hearing that and seeing it, it evokes so many emotions, pride and unease, anger and vulnerability. And she's also, you know, she very graciously emailed me back quite swiftly and said if there's anything that she can do to help, to reach out to her. So, yeah, I'm just, you know, going through any channel that I can that's available to me, using that diplomacy and using social conscience. I mean, we're UK citizens, but, you know, I've been privy to many, many comments from the US, and there are many people, you know, in the US, and there are many law-abiding people in the US that, you know, exercise their Second Amendment, their right to bear arms, and they obviously treat firearms with the utmost respect. And, you know, I know that many people are horrified by what has happened.
Jane Coates talking to Jane Garvey, and Jane is the mother of Lucy Harrison. It's 18 minutes past three. We are going to talk sport with Vassos, and after 3:30, we're going to talk women's prize contenders for the non-fiction part of the prize. This is Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
It's rowing's greatest rivalry. 197 years of history, drama and sporting prowess. And this April, Times Radio will bring you live and exclusive coverage of the 2026 Oxford versus Cambridge boat race. Hear all the build-up to the race across the Times Radio schedule, culminating in a special program on the 4th of April to bring you stroke-by-stroke coverage of both the men's and the women's races live. The Boat Race, coming soon, live and exclusively on Times Radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas, and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Every day after 3:30 on this programme, you hear a fantastic interview with a brilliant guest. If you miss it, though, don't worry, because you can listen to it on our podcast, Off Air with Jane and Fee, which drops around 6 p.m. every weekday evening. New episode Monday to Friday. Current topics: overwhelming scent on public transport, the relevance of kitchen towel, if being companies, big companies, can hear you when they put you on hold, and one of Jane Garvey's classics, I never get tired of hearing about it, actually, will moving pavements ever be a thing? 10 years on, we still haven't managed to answer that question. Recently, we've had Sean Williams, Nancy Birtwistle, Zach Goldsmith, Jenny Godfrey, and last week, Jane spoke to Pam Ayres. The world can be a bleak place, and Pam's poetry is so funny and comforting. Jane asked Pam if she's often moved to poetry by current affairs.
Well, I snipe from the sidelines on Twitter, as it used to be. And I didn't ever want to go on Twitter or X as it is now because I didn't see the point. But what it's actually given me the opportunity to do is comment on topical things. So I've had a few swipes at Donald Trump and tax and just topical things. So I do have a bit of fun with it, but not in an ominous way and not in a serious political way. I have a bit of fun with current events, but there isn't much to have fun with now.
Not right now. I mean, the thing about Trump, there are many things about Trump. His name, it's got to be good for a rhyme.
Mm. Well, the last swipe I took at Donald Trump was about when he said, in order to overcome COVID, you should inject yourself with bleach. And I thought that was so hysterical. I thought I must have a go at that. So that was good fun. But I don't comment seriously on politics. I think other people are much better placed to do that than me. I try and make people smile.
Yeah, I'd kind of forgotten that fever dream that was Donald Trump recommending that we all inhale or inject bleach. I just remember the scientist who was sitting in that press conference.
Space.
Yeah, because he looked over to her for reassurance. Wasn't that? You can download that and many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcasts from.
Ipswich Town have insisted that they do not endorse Reform UK after Nigel Farage caused a stir among some supporters for making a campaign video at their stadium. The party leader posted images of himself signing for the club and holding up a number 10 shirt with his name on it, which has angered some supporters. While sports journalist Vassos Alexander joins us now. Vassos, tell us about this, Nigel Farage's latest campaign.
So he was in Suffolk. I think he was addressing some people in Ipswich town centre later that day, 900 people apparently ahead of the local elections. But he had booked himself and his campaign team a tour of Ipswich town's Portman Road ground and took the opportunity to personalise a shirt, as you say, his name and the number 10 on it. You had a picture of him sort of pseudo-signing for the club, like in one of those, you know, media conferences. He's pretending to sign a document. He's got a picture of himself in the changing room with all the club shirts hanging up, and he's put Farage 10 in one of the lockers. He's also holding up his shirt in front of the pitch. Basically, it's a Nigel Farage signs for Ipswich Town kind of thing, and the banner along the post was, "I've never been too bad on the right wing," which is quite funny, actually. But and so he then
not sure what the right wingers would think about that, but okay.
what the actual football right wingers? Yes. So then cue the storm, right? Cue Norwich City, Ipswich Towns. I mean, if you are in charge of the Norwich City Twitter account, X account, and don't have some fun with this, then you know you're not doing your job properly. So obviously they did. Norwich City stadium tours available. Terms and conditions most definitely do apply. And yes, and Ipswich, as you say, have had to say we do not endorse any political party. And in fact, one of the Labour councillors, whose business he says, a guy called Kevin Craig, a local Labour councillor whose business, he says, has been trying to sponsor the Ipswich Town Foundation, the charity associated with the football club. And they don't want his sponsorship or his thousands of pounds, he says, because they don't want to appear to be political. He says, well, so all of that, right? And then this? Question mark. And you sort of can see his point too.
Did the club actually approve him going to do it? Because hasn't there been a suggestion that the club didn't know he was going to do it?
Yeah,
what did they think Nigel Farage was going to do at Portman Road? I mean, Nigel Farage is constantly battling with Ed Davey over who does the biggest stunts. What do they think he was going to do?
There is that. There is absolutely that. Yeah. What Nigel Farage? No, he's just what's the wonder around the pitch? And he would have got me these photos. I've had a look at them, and they're all available on the article on the Times online. They all look pretty well staged, well photographed. This wasn't him doing it with a selfie. This is definitely him going with a team who would have staged these stunts, and the photographs are all very well done. You know, they're perfectly framed, they're perfectly lit. He's, you know, his the way he's holding up the shirt with the pitch behind him, they're not easy to do, these shots. So he'd have had professionals with him. So yes, Nigel Farage plus team turning up at Portman Road. And also they don't happen just instantaneously. No. These take some framing. So yeah, they are, according to sources, very embarrassed in Ipswich Town.
How have the supporters responded?
Well, they're some of them very cross.
Mm.
I mean, some of them think it's a fuss about nothing, but you know what it's like on X and social media. You know, the people who are outraged shout a lot. I mean it's a small thing, right? This is just, you know, it's a little storm, but it's still a storm.
Mm. Well, I mean, he has said that if he doesn't get the next job at number 10, he'll put himself forward as manager, but we'll see about that. Now, Vassos, on the Times at 1, Joe Coburn was speaking to Georgia Hunter-Bell, who, yes, as we were talking about earlier, was part of that wonderful, wonderful evening where we saw three golds. She won gold in the 1500-metre race in the World Indoor Championships. And she spoke about her fellow British champion, the 800-metre Keely Hodgkinson, and how she helped her relax.
In the past, I would be very rigid and say, you know, like, this needs to be the shoes that I'm training in, and this needs to be the time that we get to the session. And if anything goes wrong, that means, you know, the plan's gone the wrong way and I might have a bad race. And actually, she is so relaxed that that's rubbed off on me in a positive way. So in the call room, before we went out onto the track, I thought I had my phone on me and I didn't. I spilled a bottle of water completely. Oh, no. Didn't have the top on, so it spilled all over my bag. So like these small things that are happening before you're going on, and I did really think, like, yeah, it's fine, no problem, like, don't stress about it.
I mean, it sounds like she used to be under a lot of pressure, but is sort of managing that now. She's changed how she manages it.
She took some time away from the sport, actually. It was only during COVID that she rediscovered the joy of running, as we were discussing earlier in the week, actually. And then she went to her local park run and started smashing it out the butt, and then thought, actually, let's give it another go, even though I've got an actual, you know, a graduate job in cybersecurity. And she has, you know, she talked about in that interview, it's fascinating, the sacrifices that you have to make as an elite athlete, missing weddings, missing funerals, missing family events, because you have to dedicate yourself 100% to the training, to the process, and then there is no guarantee that you're going to win a gold medal, which, thankfully for her, thankfully for Great Britain, she did on Sunday night. But there's no guarantee, because everybody else in that final was going for that gold medal and they'd have made the same sacrifices. So that, you know, you hear elite athletes talk about process over results, and that's what they have to think like that. They have to enjoy the process, because otherwise, if you're just results orientated, that's a fast track to mental health problems.
And very quickly, is Tiger Woods back? Is he back?
Well, his back is back. He's had seven back operations. He returned to competitive golf in his sort of indoor league last night. He said physically he's fine, and he's hoping to be back at the Masters, the big first major of the year, in a couple of weeks' time in Augusta. So you never know.
The comeback kid, always coming back. That was Vassos Alexander, and he'll be with us every day at this time. And if you want more on that story, you can go to thetimes.com and head to the sports section.
Coming up, how art can change your life, or the story of Afghanistan told through a hotel. Thangam Debonair will tell us who's up for the Women's Prize for non-fiction. It's exactly 3:30. Let's get the latest news headlines with Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, V. Good afternoon. The government says there's no conspiracy over the theft of Morgan McSweeney's phone. It's emerged Mr. McSweeney didn't tell the police who he was or that he worked at Number 10 when he reported that his phone had been stolen in October. The police said that they were unaware of the victim's employment or the particular security risks associated with his device or material on it. Police have confirmed the nationality of two men arrested over an anti-Semitic arson attack on Jewish ambulances in North London. Both are British nationals. Iranian state media is calling Donald Trump's 15-point peace plan excessive, adding it'll end the war at a time of its own choosing. The US president alleged yesterday Tehran's agreed to never have a nuclear weapon. Justin Forsyth advises Iran's crown prince, the son of the former Shah, who was exiled by the current regime. He says Donald Trump must continue the war.
We need further degradation on the ground. I mean, much of this isn't being reported. It's not just the killing of the leadership and the breakdown of the command and control structures of the arm of the security forces. It's at a street level. These militia besiege who man roadblocks in every township on streets are being attacked, and they've actually fled. There is space now for people to begin to protest again, but it's not quite there, and we need a bit more time before people can rise up again.
And there's a new man in charge at the BBC, incoming Director General Matt Britton, a Doctor Who fan, is a former Google boss and will take home a salary of £565,000. And remember, the finest writers from the Times preview and review the week's football. That's on the Game podcast.
This is Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Daryl Morris brings you a first look at the Sunday Times front page splash every Saturday night from 10:30.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Let's take a closer look at one of the regional winners in this year's Sunday Times Best Places to Live, sponsored by Lloyds.
The Sunday Times Best Places to Live on Times Radio, sponsored by Lloyds. Spotlight on Northern Ireland. Winner, Ballycastle, County Antrim.
My name is Laura and I am 19 and I'm from Ballycastle. I've got lots of family that live here and I can just, you know, go to the beach, go for a walk, you know, meet people, and I think it's just a really lovely place to be. I'm just working away here.
Okay.
Yeah, just like regular. Sometimes I would have family members come in for a coffee in here, and it's nice, you know, to meet people and you get to know people, you know, with their regular customers. So.
My name is Oliver McMullen. I'm the mayor of Causeway Coast and Glens. Ballycastle is a coastal town. It has a lot going for it. It's one of the three fairs of Ireland. It's quite a bustling town. There's a lot going for the young people in Ballycastle, for the elderly in Ballycastle, you know. So all walks of life are catered for. And plus the fact you have on the doorstep, you have Rathlin Island, the only inhabited island in the north.
Sarah McIntyre from Ballycastle, born and bred. I love the close-knit community, and it is getting a wee bit more diverse since COVID. There is people from kind of all over the world now has come to live in Ballycastle, and they've added a lot to our community, I think.
My name is Joe. We work for the Anzac. The Anzac restaurant is fantastic. You won't get a better steak elsewhere. I'm born and bred here, and I'd say it's a very nice environment to grow kids. I say I've got three kids, and it's a very peaceful, very safe environment. I say there's no hassle, no trouble. I say it's a nice wee sort of scenic spot. You know, I'd say it's a bit like the views. It's epic. At the weekend, there's no better place. I say I'm out most mornings there at 5:30 walking around the town. And I say it's hard to beat the sort of the seafront view there.
Eamon Gomez, and I'm from Ballycastle, and I'm 18 years old. I go to Northern Regional College in Corrie and do health and social care. I say it has just really nice sights, and it's like lively. There's little cafes around go about, and they're just nice walks and stuff. It's just a nice view. I'd say from Ballycastle, there's like little points like around the coast. You can go, like, it's like the main point, and when you get the Causeway Rambler, you go to the Giant's Causeway and all the wee points like Bushmills. But in Ballycastle itself, I'd say the walk itself along the beach and just exploring the wee town and the wee bars as well.
That was a quick look at Ballycastle, this year's winner for Northern Ireland in the Sunday Times Best Place to Live, sponsored by Lloyds.
The Sunday Times Best Places to Live on Times Radio, sponsored by Lloyds. Spotlight on Northern Ireland. Winner, Ballycastle, County Antrim.
It's now 24 minutes to four. How can art change your physical health? How one hotel tells the story of Afghanistan. How a brother and sister's artistic talents cause Hollyoaks-style friction in their lifetimes and a divided legacy in death. These are just some of the themes of the books on the shortlist for the Women's Prize for Non-Fiction this year. It is a fabulous selection of writing. Chair of judges is Baroness Debonair, Fangham Debonair, former Labour MP and now Labour peer and CEO of UK Opera Association. That's worth knowing ahead of hearing this chat, which we recorded a little earlier today. And it started with a question about women in the non-fiction world of publishing. Are they being given the same opportunity as the blokes?
I mean, the publishing industry is definitely giving us more. And so, for instance, if you pick two categories, popular science and philosophy, women's published writing in both those categories has gone up over the last sort of 5-10 years quite considerably. We're at, I think, 22%, something like that, in popular science. I mean, that's quite a jump. However, it's still the minority. And I think that part of the reason for the increase is the increased attention, the increased number of women recognised as experts in their field across all areas of public and professional life. So there's just more women who will get book deals. And also, and I possibly would say this, wouldn't I? I think that the Women's Prize per se, Women's Prize for Fiction, of course, originally for so many years, and then more recently the Women's Prize for Nonfiction, it has an impact because it's shining a light on what tends to happen. Even now, if you walk into many a bookshop and you look at the nonfiction section, and I do it all the time, and you count the number of women and you count the number of men, it's not hard to guess. You know, it's mostly men still, but it's better. And I've been counting since well before my involvement with the Women's Prize for Nonfiction, and I've been counting for years. So I know just very empirically and experientially it's gone up, but also some of the data that we've had recently published shows that it is so. It's on the increase, but we're still in the minority, and in some notable categories, very much in the minority. Yeah.
We will talk about the individual books, of course, so please, dear listeners, don't worry about that. But just one other question about the book sales themselves. It has always been the case that women will read male fiction in a way that men don't read female fiction, and I wonder whether or not that's the same for nonfiction.
What's really interesting about that, about who reads what, is that women are much more likely to read nonfiction by women. So one thing I would say to my dear friends and colleagues in the publishing industry is publish more books by the brilliant women. It doesn't mean publish books that aren't any good. It means look around, realise that there are some fantastic women who are brilliant writers and experts in their field. Publish more books, and guess what? You will sell more books because there are a lot of women out there who are currently more likely to buy a book if it's by a woman than by a man, and we just don't yet have, I think, our equal, our fair share of publishing on the non-fiction side.
In the non-fiction category, the spectrum is just glorious, isn't it? So we're going to start with The Finest Hotel in Kabul, A People's History of Afghanistan by Lise Doucette. Regular listeners to our show and the podcast will know that we talked to Lise about this book. It's a very clever concept, isn't it? Because although it is nonfiction and it's talking about a particular hotel, using that as the lens for history, she brings it to life in sometimes an almost fictional way.
I think what Lise does so well in this book is use a literary device. Using a hotel as a literary device is fantastic. I mean, you know, films can do it as well, and they often do. And I think books doing it is brilliant because you can bring characters on and off stage and still have an overarching narrative thread, which she does. And it's told so well, partly because Lise is a brilliant teller of stories. She's been a fantastic journalist in our ears for so many years through so many conflicts, and she is even now probably somewhere on the airwaves somewhere talking about a conflict. And what she does so well in this story is pull together such a span of the existence and the history and the lives being lived in a country which, for many people, remains just, it's a country far away. We sent troops there 20-odd years ago. It was a mess when we came out, and it must be awful for women, which is true. But what Lise does is she tells that story in a way which gives Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan, agency and voice.
And also, everybody just loves a hotel.
Everyone loves a hotel. It's such a great device. It just is.
It is.
And she tells it, you know, through the staff that work there, but also the people who come in and out. And because it was and remains, I believe, a very important hotel for the journalists covering the many stories of Afghanistan. I love the way that Lise actually, she does appear in the book, but in the third person.
Yeah, I think she's the last person to want to put herself herself at the centre of the story.
It's brilliant.
It's the secret of her great journalism. Art Cure, The Science of How the Arts Transform Our Health by Daisy Fancourt. Now, if you are suffering from a little bit of, oh my goodness, where do I go to find joy in the world, make myself feel good, make myself feel better, this is a book for you.
Oh, it absolutely is. I'm really sorry, listeners, and V, I'm going to keep saying brilliant because I think every single one of these books is brilliant. What this one is so brilliant at is if you've ever experienced the joy of going to an art gallery, being at the cinema, watching a fantastic play live on stage with other human beings in the room, being in an orchestral concert or in any number of places where you are experiencing different forms of art, you probably already knew this empirically inside you, but here we are with Daisy Fancourt producing a fantastic piece of science. It provides us with really good, well-grounded, well-argued scientific evidence for what the various benefits are. And some of them were unexpected to me. And I spent my life in performing arts in particular and arts and culture in general. And yet I was still like, that is really interesting. Many people, I think, will assume when they hear that it's about the evidence of the health benefits for arts and culture, will think that's going to be mostly mental health. And brilliantly, what she does is pick out actually other benefits that we may not have thought of. I think, for instance, looking at the benefits of dance, for example, where she says, if you compare dance with physiotherapy for people with injuries to recover from, it's more effective. And I think there's multiple reasons why it would. And then when you think about it, you think, well, of course it is. It's more enjoyable. Therefore, you'll probably do more of it. But instead of it just being, I think this is probably so therefore it is, we can now, those of us in performing arts, arts and culture, including literature, can point to something and go, see, there is proof. Art actually is good for you. That's not in and of itself a reason to go do it, but it is a reason to start thinking about how we value arts and culture. And I would say this, wouldn't I? But as a political actor, I've got to say that's got to include thinking about how we pay for social prescribing. Because a lot of what Daisy Fancourt's talking about is available now through social prescribing, and very often it won't be properly recompensed for the people providing it.
I'm quite happy to talk about the political side of your life, Baroness Devlin, because you're in the Lords as a Labour peer to kind of help give voice to their cultural strategy. And I wonder whether, when you read a book like this, how do you then make sure that some of what it talks about and the evidence that it presents does get back into policy?
I mean, I hope that the publishers send this not just to culture, arts and culture ministers, and not just in Westminster, but also, in Holyrood, in Cardiff, in Northern Ireland. I'd like them to remember that it's actually for health ministers. It is for health policy makers. It's for education ministers. It's for the employment ministers, actually, because there's a hell of a lot of jobs involved in this. I think it's really, really valuable. I've not seen anything quite like it for giving the evidence, but also, importantly, for the Women's Prize. It's a beautiful piece of writing, yet again. It's well told, and there are stories in there to illustrate the evidence. Brilliantly told.
We are going to come back just for a quick question about opera, because I cannot not ask you about Timothée Chalamet's comments. So hold that in our heads as we go to number three. This is by Judith Mackrell, Artist Siblings Visionaries, The Lives and Loves of Gwen and Augustus John. Now, this sounds like a kind of family epic that you could then see on Channel 5, maybe, at a time of your choosing in the afternoons. Tell us a bit more.
Well, it would make a great film. I mean, or docuseries or something. I mean, I'm hoping that it goes straight to screen somewhere, because it's a brilliant story of sibling rivalry, of sibling passions and fallings out and arguments. But she doesn't do that at the expense of really good, rigorous art criticism. So her exploration of how both those careers developed, and the supreme irony of the fact that during his lifetime it was Augustus John that was the famous one, and actually now when you look at their outputs of work, it's clear that Gwen John was really arguably the better artist, or at least equivalent. And there is an exhibition on at my local art gallery, the National Museum of Wales in Cardiff, of Gwen John's work. And having read this book many times now, as I have all the books on the shortlist, it gave me an added passion to see the exhibition. So I encourage people to do that and to link back perhaps to one of the other books, Art Cure, the therapeutic effect of looking at works of art added to the benefit of having read this book and really getting under the skin of who Gwen John was and her relationship to Augustus John. It's just brilliant. It multiplies the effect. Again, fantastic stories. Brilliantly told, some quite punchy writing in places where you think, wow, that's really, really interesting, because it also gives you a window into the lives of young artists from really quite modest backgrounds at the beginning of the 20th century and what it was like to break into that world, which in turn gives you a bit of social history. Plus, they were unconventional, both of them.
Excellent. Hotel Exile, Paris in the Shadow of War by Jane Rogoiska. It's not the same kind of thing as the Intercontinental Hotel that Lise Doucette's writing about, but it is about war, isn't it?
There are some parallels, and yet it's a very different tale. So again, Jane Rogoiska does use a hotel as a vehicle, but not in quite the same way. She uses it more as a vehicle because it literally was the place. Jewish people who survived the camps, which wasn't many, came to the Hotel Lutetia after the war. Jewish refugees before the war who were escaping Nazi Germany, and she talks particularly about those people in politics, literature, philosophy, arts, who came there to meet, to discuss, to plan. And there's some really quite sad episodes where some of them are meeting to try and discuss what they think is going to be a successful sort of outpouring of resistance against Hitler and the Nazis, and of course isn't. But then the ways it was used by the Nazis during the war is also just fascinating. And she uses it as a jumping off point to tell the tales of those people who came in and out of the hotel, who are, it's often a tale of imaginable loss, both to the individuals, but also to us, because she focuses so heavily on people from arts and culture and politics and philosophy, and the loss of those lives. And so many of her characters do end up in the camps and don't survive or come to other very unhappy ends. It is quite powerful to feel that loss in the way that she's telling the story. But it's also a superbly written piece of history in what could look like quite a crowded field, Paris in the war. But it takes that apart, and it looks very particularly at the effect of the war and exile on particularly Jewish refugees.
Yeah, and a good book to read in the now, isn't it?
It's got so much that's relevant for the now.
Mother Mary Comes to Me by Arundhati Roy. Now, tell me about this.
Well, Arundhati Roy is, of course, a novelist. And if you've ever read The God of Small Things, and I think quite possibly quite a lot of your readers will, your listeners will have read that book, it explains a lot. So there's a bit of, if you haven't read God of Small Things, maybe do that first. But I think you don't need to. You could read this book. It's a memoir, but it's an exploration of a mother-daughter relationship. It's an exploration of what it was like for a feisty young woman to make her own way in the world, in India, in intellectual circles, in artistic circles beyond India, and to be involved in politics. Because, of course, Arundhati Roy, after writing The God of Small Things, spends most of the following two decades being an activist and a non-fiction writer. So reading her memoir, which is unflinching, but also never self-pitying, even when she's obviously going through some very difficult times, she doesn't tell it in a self-pitying way. She tells it in a really strong, compelling narrative. And yes, it unlocks the secrets of some of The God of Small Things.
Yeah, it's interesting that this is published now, because so many writers are advised, aren't they, to write their memoir first, put their own life on the page before they then start writing fiction. So it's a lovely turnaround in that respect.
It is. And I think, although we obviously do have memoir on the list, including this one, I think what's been wonderful about the books on the shortlist that are also memoir is that they aren't just memoir. They are taking that art form as a vehicle, that genre as a vehicle, to tell about other things in which they are also expert.
Nation of Strangers, Rebuilding Home in the 21st Century by Eke Temelkuran. Now, that sounds fantastic.
It's beautiful. It's a beautifully told set of stories in many ways, but it's also the story of the author's journey as a migrant. And again, very timely, sadly, because it's it forces you, when you're reading it, you get engrossed in the story because she tells a tale brilliantly, but you are forced to confront what may be even your own prejudices, which you may not even think you have, about migration, about what it's like to be a migrant, and about the dehumanisation of the many bureaucratic processes that someone has to go through, even in a country that appears on the surface to be very welcoming of people from another country. Even countries that say that they're welcoming of refugees fleeing war and conflict is challenging. And I think, again, this is a book which is... it has relevance for policymakers, as well as being a wonderful, beautiful, sometimes heartbreaking piece of writing, which is memoir, but takes on the subject of migration, which is very, very now.
And it's always so important, isn't it, to try and understand an individual story before you try and understand a massive policy. And, I mean, it's interesting that you say... we are a country that's welcoming, because I think a lot of people would feel that that is actually not exactly what we're sending out as a message anymore.
It's interesting that you should say that, Fee, because I don't think I did say we are a country that's welcoming. I said it's about countries that say they are welcoming.
Well, that's a very interesting thing to pick up
on. And I was quite careful about that for a reason. And yeah. Again, as a political actor, I think... that's one of the reasons why I challenge people to read it, because although she is in Britain some of the time, I think we are at a time when an awful lot of countries, an awful lot of policymakers, an awful lot of politicians who would present themselves as of being progressive, having progressive values, seem to have absorbed the idea that the only way you can get ahead in modern politics is by being at best tough, shall we say, on migration. And I think that undermines our own countries, but other countries as well, messages on being a welcoming place for people fleeing war and conflict. Because in my view, there shouldn't be any but in that sentence. And that's what the Ece Temelkuran book does, is it doesn't allow you to say, well, we're welcoming, but on the other hand, there's a limit, or we should be careful, or we need to put our own people first. One of the things she does brilliantly is actually challenge a lot of those assumptions and say, well, first of all, are you really welcoming? Second of all, why are we making these distinctions? Why are we not also viewing the value, the enormous value that people who are migrating to another country make to the country that they go to and always have? Why are we not actually saying our policies need to reflect that valuing? Why are we not reflecting the fact that most of us, I mean, Northern European countries, America, the United Kingdom, we are countries whose histories are built on migration.
So you sit in the House of Lords now. If you were sitting in the House of Commons on the front bench, would you be able to have said all of that? Would you be advised to maybe then temper it with something else?
Well, I can't say. I mean, I'm a backbencher in the House of Lords. I'm not on the front bench in the House of Commons. And I think my colleagues are doing their best in difficult circumstances, but I'm presenting my view here, and I'm presenting it as chair of the Women's Prize for Nonfiction, which is that this book, I think, for my colleagues in the world of politics, for the public, and after all, politicians try their best to reflect the views of the public, and I think there is a range of views in the public, and I often think perhaps we need to be listening to the public more, because what I hear very often from people of all sorts of backgrounds is a valuing of our history and a wanting to understand it more. And I think this book gives you a way into understanding how important migration is, told through a beautifully told story. And if I was on the front bench, I hope that I would.
You are also the CEO of the UK Opera Association, and I'm going to return to the comments recently made by Timothy Chalamet, who basically said that opera had kind of died. It was just over. It had had its day, and it wasn't really very relevant. I mean, there was immediately, I think if you're from the operatic community, a very heartening backlash against that. But when you saw that, what did you think?
Well, my first thought, and it's partly my political background, is I thought, don't react to something that's an absolute wind-up. You just give it more publicity. And it didn't seem to do him any favours, either in the immediate sort of response to his comments or in the the Oscars. I don't think he won an Oscar, did he? So, you know, I don't think it proved to be the good luck charm he might have thought it was. You know, first off, the thing was, it just wasn't true. I mean, opera and ballet are very much still with us. And the art form that is ballet, actually, let's widen it out into dance. Dance is in so many people's lives in so many different ways. And, you know, I'm on the board of Sadler's Wells, for instance, and I know that the range of dance that we put on, that to packed houses very often, but also people who you might not expect of being in a theatre watching live dance and live ballet, is extraordinary. And it's thriving and it's developing and it's taking on new forms that wouldn't have existed even 50 years ago. Opera similarly. The sheer range of work that's happening in opera is extraordinary. I think he was acting for his own reasons. And actually, I think we're quite strong in art forms. We are art forms for the 21st century. Opera and ballet and dance. We are telling new tales all the time. We are finding new ways to tell old tales. We're also finding surprising resonances from some of the classics, just as you do in literature. Sometimes the classics actually remind you of things that are still true. Mm. So I hope he comes to an opera or a ballet. I think he might find it surprises him, but also we're very much alive and kicking. We welcome audiences from all backgrounds. People often say, oh, it's too expensive, when actually when I look at the price of opera, it's incredibly competitive. And we almost all opera houses have really good sort of entry-level prices. I know this is like my advertising pitch for opera, but I'd say don't knock it till you tried it, Timothy.
Well, I paid £22.50 to go and see Marty Supreme, and I'd like at least half of that back.
I couldn't possibly comment.
That was Thangam Debonair, the former Labour MP and now Labour peer. You can find all the books that are being discussed on the shortlist at thewomensprize.com. It's just gone 5 to 4. This is Fee Glover and Roy Nika on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Coming soon, rowing's greatest rivalry, live and exclusively on Times Radio.
Young people today, can they really handle responsibility? Or are we just kidding ourselves?
Welcome to McDonald's.
And a mayo chicken.
Some think young people can't manage. We disagree. That's why 1 in 3 McDonald's managers are under 25.
Hey, Kira.
Hey, girl. How are you?
Right? Yeah, I'm good. It's busy out there, though.
Like Kira from South London. She's 23 and manages a team of 20.
Let's go.
Leadership, making it happen at McDonald's.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Well, that's it from me today. Fee and Jane will be with you tomorrow from 2. You can hear even more of them on their daily podcast, Off Air with Jane and Fee. And you can hear more from me on my podcast, The Royals 2, available wherever you get your podcasts from. Our producer today was Rosie Cutler, and our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, it's John Pienaar with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Roy. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Iranian state media is calling Donald Trump's 15-point peace plan excessive, adding it'll end the war at a time of its own choosing. The Prime Minister's poised to cap political donations from Britons living abroad in a move which could cut off Reform's UK's biggest donor. And coming up, what are the UK ground forces on their way to Iran planning to do when they reach that theatre of war? And will the engagement secure a quick end or an elongation of the conflict? And we're going to be looking at the criticism directed at Keir Starmer for his approach to tackling rising living costs associated with that war in the Middle East.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The Metropolitan Police have rejected claims they were too busy to speak to Morgan McSweeney over the theft of his phone. It's emerged he didn't tell officers he worked at Number 10. Times Radio's Laura Cook has the details.
The PM's former chief of staff had his phone stolen a month after Sir Keir Starmer sacked Lord Mandelson as US ambassador. He called 999 saying a government device had been taken. He said he gave chase, but the thief got away. The police say they were unaware of the victim's employment or the particular security risks. They added officers tried to contact him twice but didn't receive a response. The theft of the device means none of McSweeney's WhatsApp messages will be released as they weren't backed up.
Iran has dismissed an American proposal to end the war against it and proposed counter-demands, which include payment of war damages and reparations. It's outlined five specific conditions under which Iran would agree to end the war, including concrete mechanisms to ensure the war does not break out again and guaranteed and clearly defined payment of war damages. It's also asked for international recognition and guarantees regarding Iran's sovereign right to exercise authority over the Strait of Hormuz. The exiled crown prince, Reza Pahlavi, is among those calling for Trump to press on in the war to ensure full regime change. Justin Forsyth advises the Crown Prince, and he's spoken to Times Radio.
A lot of the military strikes have been specifically targeted at the Revolutionary Guards and the besieged, not the army. And large sections of the army will break ranks at the right moment and defend the people. So what we're asking President Trump to do at this moment is to continue what he is doing. I mean, I know that's not a popular view in the UK or in creating the space. They're levelling the playfield. They're allowing at the right moment for the Iranian people to overthrow this regime.
Police have confirmed the nationality of two men arrested over an arson attack on Jewish ambulances in North London on Monday. They're aged 45 and 47 and both are British nationals. Two addresses are being searched. Dame Sarah Mullally has been installed as the first female Archbishop of Canterbury. The Prince and Princess of Wales are representing the King at Westminster Abbey and are among the 2,000 guests in attendance. Speaking before the service, Dame Sarah has vowed to create a safe space for differing viewpoints in the church.
My natural nature has always been is to create a space where all are welcome. And certainly for me, that what I seek to do is to support everybody's ministry, regardless of their theological view. And there is a sense in which, what a lesson to the world.
That service is taking place at Canterbury Cathedral. And former Google executive Matt Britton has been confirmed as the BBC's new Director General. The ex-president of Google's Europe, Middle East and Africa operations will replace Tim Davey, who said he was resigning in November following a storm over how Panorama edited a speech by Donald Trump. BBC chairman Samir Shah said Britton brings to the BBC deep experience of leading a high-profile and highly complex organisation through transformation. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. So, Iran has received America's terms for peace in this war, and their answer is no. So, is this conflict about to escalate? As I speak, thousands of pairs of American military boots, US Marines and paratroopers are on their way to the war zone. Let us then talk about what happens when they get there. And as for the plan for peace, well, Donald Trump says there is a 15-point plan on offer to Iran to stop the bombing and lift sanctions, or at least some of them. Iran is mocking the idea. Talks have been going on that are worth pretty much anything. Tehran says, has been saying, Trump's been negotiating with himself, and now they're simply saying the terms they've been given will not do the trick. But if we assume contacts have been made, and now we know that has been the case, albeit through intermediaries, what does that plan really amount to? Is it just a repeat of past proposals? Does it amount to terms of surrender? Is there any realistic chance, whatever Iran says now, of it leading to some kind of deal, to use President Trump's favourite word. Let's talk about that. And what do you think? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. And also, on the on the show today, President's announcement earlier this week that he was stepping back from escalating the war, that sent oil prices tumbling and markets spiking upwards. Is it possible someone with inside advanced knowledge of the announcement used it to make a killing on the market? If so, that would be insider trading, wouldn't it? Even criminal corruption. Well, what on earth went on there? Well, let's talk about what did go on there. First, though, we've had lots of mixed signals out of both Iran and the United States. President Trump says he's secured regime change in Iran, that he's negotiating with Iran's new leaders. And as U.S. troops are reported to be heading into the region, well, maybe there's talk now of an operation to seize the strategic economic post of Karg Island. If that happens, what will that mean to? One of President Trump's most senior supporters, Congressman Lindsey Graham, told Fox News the U.S. should seize the island.
Here's what I tell President Trump. Keep it up for a few more weeks. Take Karg Island, where all of the resources they have to produce oil, control that island. Let this regime down a vine. Sort of tired of all this armchair quarterbacking. This has been an amazing military operation. Mm-hmm. I trust DOD. We got two Marine Expeditionary Units sailing to this island. We did Iwo Jima. We can do this.
That was Senator Lindsey Graham speaking on Fox News. We can now talk to Benoit Fossan, the security and Middle East correspondent at the Wall Street Journal. Benoit, hello.
Hello.
What are your thoughts on this, Benoit? Ground forces are going to be arriving, some thousands, not a massive force, but some thousands of US Marines and airborne troops. They're going to be there within a very few days. How do you believe these forces might be used when and if they are called into action?
I mean, yes, the next step that hasn't been explored yet is really to, you know, occupy Karg Island, which would disrupt a lot of the revenues of the regime, but actually not really interrupt all the revenue flows because, you know, there are alternative routes typically in the next to, you know, in the Gulf of Oman, where Iran can still export smaller quantities. But yeah, that would be the next step up if there's going to be further escalation. Other than that, it's obviously the destruction of energy facilities in Iran that the president has threatened. And that has been, remember, just suspended. It hasn't been cancelled entirely.
Right, and that was the threat that the president stepped back from just days ago. Let's talk a little bit more about Karg Island then, which is, of course, a vital oil storage and export centre for Iran. Now, if American forces were able to seize it, what kind of stranglehold, what strength of stranglehold would that impose on the Iranian economy? As you say, there are other ways of doing business and moving oil around.